Shrink Wrap Radio number 777. Peter Whitehouse, MD, and Daniel George, PhD, on brain health in an unhealthy society.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
The fear of Alzheimer's disease is a source of anxiety for many aging Americans. And my guests today are Peter Whitehouse, MD, and Daniel George, PhD. In their book, American Dementia, they denounce the narrow biomedical fixation that has plagued the Alzheimer's field for decades. Instead, they advocate for a public health approach. Now, here is the interview. Dr. Peter Whitehouse and Dr. Dan George, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hey, thanks for having us, Dave. We appreciate it.
Great to be here.
Yeah, good, good. We're going to have some fun, I think. We're going to be talking about your book, American Dementia, Brain Health in an Unhealthy Society. You don't pull your punches in the title there. And what's the story behind this book? How did it come to be?
Yeah, so we didn't pull our punches in the first book we wrote, too, which was called The Myth of Alzheimer's, a similar provocative title. We wrote that in 2008, and that connects to the story of this book, too. So we, of course, all remember in the wake of 2008, the election that we had, then the Great Recession that followed that. And it felt like a lot in our lives became political, and that was just the water that we all swam in. It was kind of impossible to ignore income inequity, wealth inequality, those sorts of things in the culture. And so, you know, Peter and I were thinking about writing a second book, and this goes back to November of 2016 when we had another fairly large election in this country. But also that month, there were two major studies in the Alzheimer's field. One, a drug called solanezumab, which was an anti-amyloid antibody that had been hyped up for years. It failed in its phase 3 trial, as so many other drugs have. However, that same month, there was a study that made the front page of the New York Times. It was in JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association, by our friend Ken Lange at Michigan, showing that there's actually been a decline in dementia rates in the United States over the past decade. And so from that paradox that, you know, drugs fail yet again, but dementia rates appear to be declining in the U.S. and in also in 5 other Western European countries and Canada, emerged this book, which asks the question, why, if the biotechnology has failed so profoundly, are we seeing these declining rates of dementia in these industrialized countries?
Okay, well, you've just answered about 3 or 4 of the questions I was going to ask you, and that's fine. We're getting into deep water quickly here. The main title, American Dementia, can be taken a couple different ways. What's behind that?
Well, I'm going to take credit for that one. The operating title of the book for the entire time we were writing was called Brain Health in an Unhealthy Society. And Danny's just articulated why that became the core of our work. People said, well, you need a pithy beginning. You need a couple of words title to start off with. And I had been promoting American Dementia for exactly the reason that you said, David. It has multiple meanings. It could just refer to the clinical picture that America has, but it doesn't. It refers to what we call a cultural dementia. That is to say that if you ask what is a clinical dementia, and I'm the clinician of the two, it's somebody who has some cognitive challenges, some memory problems, who can't perform well in daily life. But then you ask, well, how good are we in the dementia field or in our culture in general at remembering the lessons from the past, to planning the future, or at actually engaging in activities of daily living, which of course gets us back into that environmental conversation. How good a stewards have we been of our planet? So we like to think that there's something fundamentally wrong, I'll use that word since we want to be provocative, with the way our culture looks at addressing aging in the brain. And so this book is all about trying to essentially, Danny, like I'll use, steal one of Danny's lines for change. It's not a self-help book. It's an other help book. How do we help ourselves together collectively to develop better social responses to the challenges that older people and younger people face as they grow older with regard to their thinking abilities?
Who is your reader? What reader do you imagine as you were working on this book?
You know, that's a funny question. Dan, let's both answer that one, because it's always the intelligent lay person, right? But I think in our case, we're trying to inspire citizenship. We're trying to have people who are interested not only in their brains and their own aging process, but where we are as a civilization and what we need to do to transform it. So I'm going to say our reader is somebody who's just primed to take a deeper look at some of these issues we've been getting very superficial stories to and doing something about.
Yeah, I could certainly build on that. You know, most of the books in the dementia care space are targeted to baby boomers, people who are very concerned about their own memory loss, and rightfully so. It's something that as we were talking about before the recording, Dave, we're all concerned about memory loss. But those books tend to promise people a solution or a cure that can be undertaken through a better diet or self-care or, consuming different digital gadgets or whatnot. And so, Peter and I are very skeptical of those sorts of overpromising narratives. And so as he's already laid out nicely, this book challenges people to think about how we can reorganize the culture to maximize brain health for the most number of people possible. That is the lesson that we have forgotten from the 20th century, and which we're hoping, a sort of intelligent lay reader is interested in and can sort of carry forward.
Yeah. So you guys are coming at it from a societal, cultural angle, and that is interesting because I've not run into that anywhere else in relation to this. And I have to say that the topic of Alzheimer's is of particular interest to me, partly because I just lost one of my best friends in the world to Alzheimer's. And, I wasn't it felt to me it would be uncouth to ask his wife, just how does a person die from Alzheimer's? What is it that gets them? And is it always the same, or are there a number of possibilities?
So actually, I'm sorry for your loss. My father-in-law just died with COVID in social isolation in long-term care with a mixed dementia. And I'll use that expression because we tend to talk about Alzheimer's as if it's one thing, and it's not. It's clearly a set of different conditions or syndromes. So the first answer to your question is it does depend a little bit on how that person's cognitive process goes as to what is the cause of death. For example, if it's a dementia, a cognitive impairment associated with, say, Parkinson's disease, swallowing difficulties might lead to difficulties choking on food. So the individual person the expression is, if you've seen one person with Alzheimer's or so-called Alzheimer's, you've seen one person because it's quite variable. But I think this issue of whether a dementia itself is a cause of death, it is kind of controversial. If somebody has a dementia, it's always in the background. They might have swallowing difficulties. They might not be able to get out of bed or move around, and they might develop bed sores. that frequently urinary tract infections can occur for some of the same reasons. So usually it's not the dementia itself. It's things that happen because somebody is not able to take care of themselves and move around normally. So it's usually a secondary infection.
So it sounds like a sort of a cascade of events, and that cascade differs widely. And I'm in that age range where not only am I noticing trouble remembering things and so on, and that's so common. So many people have that experience starting in maybe in their 40s or 50s. And they start to wonder, well, I wonder if I have Alzheimer's and if this is the tip of the iceberg showing up right now. I'm in a couple of groups, a men's group, small men's group. There are four of us now, and a dinner group where we don't get together for dinner anymore, but we get together on Zoom. And there's one person in both of those groups showing the beginning signs of dementia. And you know, and so we try to accommodate, so it's challenging, and it's definitely something that's out there, and I think is on everybody's mind. So, George, you made reference to a drug, you know, for a long time we were hearing about tangles and plaque, and that's the problem, is that we get this junk in our brain, and it interferes with the transmission of nerves and so on. So what's the current story on tangles and plaque?
Yeah, and that story goes back over 100 years to Dr. Alzheimer, Alois Alzheimer, who was a German psychiatrist. And he famously worked with a woman named Augusta Dieter, who was a 51-year-old German housewife who had a fairly precipitous decline into dementia. And her young age kind of was intriguing to Alzheimer because she showed symptoms that one would see in senile dementia, but at a relatively young age. And he tracked her case for 5 years, and he was a very talented histologist with the microscope. And so he did an autopsy of her brain when she passed away and documented the plaques and tangles you mentioned, which have sort of become the hallmark of Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's was pretty obscure through most of the 20th century. It was only used to refer to people, with early onset dementia. And in fact, the other cases that Alzheimer looked at, including a gentleman named Johann F., who was a laborer in Germany, he only had plaques in his brain, but no tangles. So it only took two cases for there to be significant heterogeneity in this condition. And Alzheimer himself, didn't think that this was a specific discrete disease. However, there were much later in the 20th century, there were genetic discoveries made that showed if you have, early onset mutations, they all seem to converge around the misprocessing of amyloid, which leads to plaque formation. And the theory from that is that all cases of Alzheimer's disease, not just the young onset, were driven by beta amyloid protein, which is the constituent part of that plaque. And the plaques form between neurons, and that causes a cascade of events that causes tangles and the death of neurons and so forth. But the current thinking on this, so our pharmacological efforts have all targeted amyloid as if it were toxic. And we've been very successful at removing plaques and preempting their formation and getting amyloid out of the brain. However, that hasn't correlated with any clinical benefit for any drugs, any significant clinical benefit for any drugs. And so people are really starting to question this hypothesis now, this so-called amyloid cascade hypothesis, because it has failed so spectacularly at a cost of billions of dollars. And we're now asking, what if amyloid isn't causal? What if it's an epiphenomenon of earlier damage? What if it's like scar tissue, as our friend and colleague George Perry believes? And what if we have been targeting the wrong thing all of these years, and perhaps targeting that actually damages people's brains or puts them at greater risk? And this feeds into a story, and I'll hand off to Peter because he's an expert in this. But there's been a very high profile drug approved last summer called aducanumab, which is an anti-amyloid drug, which is really troubled. And there's sort of growing concern about this drug and increasing calls for withdrawal. But I'll let Peter riff on that a little bit.
Take it away, Peter.
Well, absolutely. And I'll speak as a psychologist to you, David, a psychologist, and to others in the audience that might be interested. Because we've already alluded to the fact that this word, Alzheimer's disease, is lots of different things and has changed through history. In your groups, these folks that are showing early signs might be labeled as having mild cognitive impairment. So we're all on a continuum. But the idea that the tension is, do we think of these conditions as psychological ones, where we study memory and executive functions, or do we, as the Alzheimer's field try to do, make Alzheimer's disease just biology, just plaques and tangles? The reason that gets to be the issue is then there are a bunch of people that want to develop biomarkers, and one of those is so-called amyloid imaging. A friend of mine, Paul Hartman-Stein, was at the meeting where CMS was trying to decide whether to pay for amyloid imaging. And they kind of made the argument, well, if we do amyloid imaging, we won't need psychologists anymore to do the testing and to do the therapy. We'll just, you know, do biomarkers and then give them drugs. So that was a long-winded way of bringing psychologists into the conversation. But I think the dehumanizing element of the biomedical model is what we rail against in this book. Aducanumab was approved by the FDA just last year, the advisory committee, but it was last week. It was approved against the advice of the advisory committee. And it was approved on the basis only of biomarkers. This drug did not show any clear clinical benefit. We could go into that story at great length. It has been hugely controversial. There is a rallying movement against paying for it, against doing all, and some public policy organizations have called for withdrawing the drug. So this brought the biomedical model to a head. You define the disease on the basis of a biomarker, you treat the biomarker, and frankly, you care less about the patient and the family.
Okay. So how do you guys get to, well, let me ask you one other question that I think Dan touched on, which is you made sort of a passing reference to games and devices, right, that are being promoted as a matter of fact, I don't know the name of the company, but I regularly get emails from this one company.
Lumosity, I'm going to bet.
It's the other one.
Oh.
And I went with Lumosity for a while, got that on my cell phone, you know, would play the little games. And the other one, I can't remember their name, but they claim to have the most research support.
They all claim that. Positive Science actually named themselves like Positive Science. I don't know if that's the one you're referring to.
I think that is the one.
Yeah. It's a huge game out there. I knew I'd guess it. But anyway.
Yeah, I think that is it, as a matter of fact. And, you know, it's very tempting to think that that could do it. And we also hear that, well, if we read a lot or solve jigsaw puzzles and so on. So what about these alternative, almost technological approaches?
Yeah, so there's a multi-billion-dollar industry, as you're alluding to, and they largely target baby boomers who are frightened about memory loss, but increasingly they're targeting millennials and Zoomers on the basis of cognitive enhancement, you know, to help people in competitive knowledge economy workplaces. These things do generally don't hurt people. You know, if you play a game on your phone, if you take a supplement, if you're, if you take nutraceuticals, they're usually not harmful actively. But the marketing of these positions them as being curative in some cases, or preventative, or brain enhancing in ways that just aren't substantiated by the data. And so there's been actually a crackdown by the FTC and some other regulatory bodies to limit the sort of overpromising that happens in this marketplace of memory, as we call it. But yeah, I mean, Peter and I promote a sort of, you know, broader and richer, we believe, story about brain health, which is being active in community, volunteering, feeling a sense of purpose, a sense of connection to other people, the social bonds that give us our identity, frankly, and sustain our quality of life. One of the worst things that can happen is when people get a dementia diagnosis, there's a real stigma that adheres to that label, and it can cause a social death for people. They can get excommunicated or depersoned, and you see a real rapid decline for a lot of people who get, you know, sort of displaced. You know, you were describing your friend earlier, David, and some of your own anxieties. It made me think of a friend I have here who's retired now. He's a scientist at our hospital. He's got some mild memory loss. And so what I do is I take him out with my medical students and his wife, and we go into the woods behind our medical center, and we look for edible plants and medicinal plants, which he's encyclopedic in. He's also a bird watcher. And those things ground him in meaningful relationships, gives him something that's cognitively stimulating, gives him something to look forward to that's purposeful. He can feel like he's teaching medical students in a new generation. So when you stack something like that up, or volunteering in a school or in the community, up against a single product on your phone, you know, there's a really stark differential there. And I think there's billions of dollars spent trying to convince people that device on the game on the phone is what they should do. But really, it comes back to what makes us human and what keeps us grounded in a sense of meaningful place and sense of self.
So what other evidence do you have for this viewpoint that reengineering society, if you will, would make an impact on this dreaded condition?
Well, Peter, do you want to take that or do you want me to hop in?
So I guess the data that Danny shared, that rates of dementia are actually going down in different countries, is the best overarching evidence. Now, that is not a randomized controlled study where you assign people to different groups. I sometimes joke, because I think sense of purpose is so important, and in Japan they have a special name for it, ikigai. So I sometimes joke with audiences, okay, we're going to randomly assign this audience, half of you are allowed a purpose in life and half of you don't have a purpose in life, and we'll see who develops dementia or not. The fact is that when the interventions are more complicated, then then it's harder to do these kind of scientific studies. But I will point to Dan. I'll throw it back at Danny or congratulate him for the research that he did to get his PhD in anthropology at Oxford, where he came into the intergenerational public schools that my wife and I started. And we brought people from long-term care facilities who volunteered, but they were learning partners. They were reading mentors. They had built relationships with kids, and they would share stories from their lives or read children's books. They had mild to moderate dementia. And in that randomized control study, even though it was a small number of folks and you could criticize the study, there were clear signs that this the sense of being energized and having a purpose, which in this case was to help the lives of kids who might otherwise not have adults in their lives to read to them, for example, provided benefit. And there are lots of randomized control studies about exercise and lots of other evidence that if you put it all together, there is this comprehensive sense that societies that invest in each other, that aren't allergic to taxes, that address income inequity better than we have in this country, that don't allow drug companies to pump opioids into people. I mean, I could just go on. They take lead out of water. Well, look, let's just take lead in the water. No one's done a study where you put kids with lead in the water and kids without lead in the water and see which ones get cognitive impairment. It would be unethical. But it's very clear, and it has been clear for centuries, that lead is toxic. So why are we, to the brain and to other organs, so why are we not getting lead out of water? We made an effort in the 70s to get it out of gasoline and paint. Good. That probably contributed to some cognitive improvement. Now we've got it in the water. So let's just continue this public health focus, which we have lost.
If I understood you correctly, you said that Alzheimer's is going down in some countries, Is it going down in the U.S. or going up or staying the same?
It's been going down in the United States and then in Canada and in four other Western European countries. And when the researchers have pooled all of the data from those countries, there are two patterns that emerge that are relevant to what we're talking about now. One is that there appears to be better prevention and treatment of vascular disease in those countries over the 20th century. And secondly, that there's been increased access to formal education, specifically college education. And, you know, to understand those two patterns, you sort of have to zoom out, right, and take a big, broad picture of what happened, what investments did we make in the mid-20th century, and why is it relevant to today? This is, you know, the American dementia, the things that we've forgotten, because as Peter has alluded to, in the 20th century, after the World Wars, after the Great Depression, countries saw fit to invest in public, in healthcare systems. The United States, we got Medicare and Medicaid in the 60s, but the other countries provided universal healthcare systems that better prevented vascular disease. Things like hypertension and high cholesterol and diabetes that we know affect the vascular system and therefore the brain, which is a highly vascularized organ that requires, you know, nutrients and oxygen. So investments in healthcare systems. Smoking cessation campaigns were extremely successful in the mid-20th century. So we had 42% of the population in the U.S. smoking in the 60s. It's down to about 14% today. Another input, as Peter has alluded to, is de-leading gasoline and getting lead out of paint. That's dropped blood lead levels in the United States by 80%, a significant drop of this neurotoxin, which is also a risk factor for heart disease. And then the last large picture bit that I'll mention is that we had the GI Bill passed after World War II. So that gave access to tens of millions of people to higher education, veterans coming back from the wars. The Cold War with Russia amped up the investment in state universities and enrollments. And then we had Pell Grants in the 70s, getting more and more people into college. And again, I'll contrast this with the story about like brain training games and nutraceuticals and those sorts of things. One thing that appears extremely helpful in building cognitive reserve, you know, the ability to withstand neurodegeneration over time, is a formal education, getting college educated. For whatever reason, whether it's structural and functional changes in the brain or exactly.
We all went in for higher education.
We're all part of the solution here. But there's something about getting formal education that does appear to protect the brain to some degree. So all of those investments that we made in the 20th century, in this time of, you know, what some people might call social democracy, appear to have downstream benefits for brain health.
I want to pick up on something you said, Peter, about intergenerational schools. And you say that as if we all know what you're talking about, but I think it's something that's been important in your life and work. So can you expand on that for us?
Sure. That was a teaser to conduce a follow-up question. So thank you for it. We also did talk about it before the program started. So brain health is something you have to pay attention to your entire life. Kids need to be not exposed to lead or to air pollution or whatever else. So, and as Danny said, I think it's education through the life course, which is good for you. It's good, you know, because you get a better job. It's also good for your brain. So I'm a geriatric neurologist who was developing some of the first generation medications for Alzheimer's. And my wife was a developmental psychologist, both trained at Hopkins where we met, working with kids with individual school problems. So we had an individual focus. I was taking care of patients. She was taking care of kids. We said, what we really need is a school or a learning environment where everybody can share. Because as we were not grandparents then, but now as grandparents, we really believe that the relationships between older people and young kids is really vital for both. And so we started three public intergeneration schools in Cleveland that have done quite well. They're being studied and replicated in other parts of the world. And in these schools, the signature program is a relationship-based, narrative-based sharing of stories, either that they've written or done in books or that come from their lives. But it's experiential learning. It's taking field trips together. It's gardening together. have a big focus in the school on elders and kids working together to protect the environment, because Danny and I both believe that the climate crisis and all the associated economic injustices associated with that are really the main issue that we have to face as a species. So this idea that learning is key, and we've all celebrated that in our own lives, it needs to be distributed more equitably. And also the natural relationships between youngsters and elders have to be built into it. So that's the story of the schools. They're 20 years old now and are doing quite well.
So it seems to me I've heard of programs where they try to get kids and people who are in old age homes together, and the experience that is being mutually beneficial. But when you say schools, though, that brings up in my imagination some kind of curriculum. Well, you alluded to some of the curricular activities. What adults sign up for this school, and why?
Right. You don't take the adults and, you know, teach them the ABCs. We believe in this school that learning has to be developmentally appropriate. But that can mean the young kids. It could also mean the elders. But there are some common things that that are true across the lifespan. A learning to read. We also have math mentoring programs as well that bring the generations together. So it's not just reading, but literacy is absolutely key. And that's where it's mutual. And because the kids have an imagination that, you know, the elders can learn from as well. And this whole notion, again, I'll tell you one quick story. A woman in our school, a particular year, was getting the Volunteer of the Year Award, which we give out each year to the older person who comes in. Not sure if she came in from a long-term care facility or from the community, but basically we have people that come from all kinds of places. And so they were announcing the award, and my wife was saying, this is, you know, our mentor of the year. The kids love her. She's just great with them. And this person turned to her daughter and said, why am I getting this award? And the daughter said, because you come here every week and you volunteer and the kids love you. And the person looked at her daughter and said, I do. In other words, she had such a short-term memory problem that she couldn't remember that she volunteered on a weekly basis. And yet, here she is getting the Volunteer of the Year Award. So that says that life is a lot more than just your memory. Life is a lot more than just what you can contribute intellectually. We have a hyper-cognitive society, which is just all about moving fast and doing things quickly. Sometimes it's important to slow down and create a space where the learning can be deeper, can be relationship based, and not just, you know, how quickly you can recite the alphabet.
Yeah, you know, a lot of the interviews that I've been doing around approaches to psychotherapy also are moving in the same sort of direction that you're talking about. Hmm. They're also critical of the ways that the culture works against mental health, and are advocating for a sense of purpose, a lot of evidence for that. The whole positive psychology movement comes to mind. Have you guys been at all involved in that or thought about that, positive psychology?
Well, as a psychologist, how can you avoid Marty Seligman? And
really?
We have at our university, we have positive organizational scholarship. In fact, there's a whole movement called positive aging. I think we put on 7 international conferences around that topic. Yeah, very important at any age to look at the bright side of things and to say, you know, mental health is not all about avoiding disease. And with all the words we use shouldn't be negative. Where is the purpose and the joy and so on? Absolutely important. I do think that it can be overdone a little bit. Barbara Ehrenreich wrote a book called...
Bright-Sided.
Sorry?
Bright-Sided.
Yeah, Bright-Sided. Thank you. See, we worked together for so long, he reads my mind. The subtitle, which is something like, How the Positivity Movement is Destroying America.
I remember that book, and I was intrigued by that. I don't think I interviewed her, but I think I kind of considered it. I was actually at the APA convention where Marty Seligman came in as president and kind of announced positive psychology, and I was kind of put off by that, having been sort of allied with the humanistic psychology movement, which was really saying many of the same things, and but he was rebranding it, and so he's helped get that out there. That's for sure. What am I not asking you that you're just dying to say and get into this conversation?
Well, I can jump in there. I mean, you guys are kind of servicing some things for me. So Peter and I, over the last several years, have been promoting a concept called intergenerativity, which is this, this dynamic that happens when you bring things together that normally aren't together, that this sort of emergent property, when you bring the generations together or when you work internationally, interdisciplinary, there's something that emerges from that collaborative energy in a very powerful way. And you certainly see that in a place like the intergenerational school, these very mutual reciprocal benefits that redound to everybody who's there, regardless of age. And, we came up with intergenerativity to build on Eric Erickson, one of the great, humanist psychologists, who had this concept of, I think it was the seventh stage of aging was stagnation versus generativity. And you certainly see in our culture's treatment of people living with dementia, the stagnation part, right? The loss of place, the loss of self, the fading away, the death that leaves the body behind. And really a lot of what we're trying to do here is push back against that stigma and get into the generative elements of what people can still do to contribute and to feel part of something beyond them. And that sense of purpose that we keep coming back to. And that doesn't mean denying what's difficult. It doesn't mean like escaping into positivism about everything. Dementia can be very difficult, but there are ways that we can use things like the arts to bring people together. This morning, I just had my medical students in a skilled nursing home in their locked unit doing time slips, which is a creative storytelling project with people with fairly advanced dementia. And for an hour and a half, there was nothing but laughter and witty, surrealistic comments coming forward in these sessions that were written into stories that the students are now developing into final projects. So you see that not with just storytelling, but with the arts, as you mentioned before, David, with pet therapy, with even clown therapy is being used, taking people from assisted living homes to museums and having them engage in the emotional impact of viewing art and talking about art. You know, so the key is really to not think about people with dementia as a separate subspecies. They're human beings, as Peter said, just a little further along the continuum. And it's sort of incumbent on us. There's a moral challenge for us to find ways to connect with them and to find those moments of intergenerativity.
Yeah, that's really.
Can I take that on and just answer the same question, which is an interesting question? And I'm going to say the following. We think of rethinking dementia and brain health as a lever for social change that has implications far beyond the brain and far beyond Alzheimer's. It builds on what you both have been talking about, that if we rethink our relationship to people with dementia, we create the humanity in that relationship, that affects us. So our attitudes towards people with cognitive challenges, as I like to call it, reflects on our own humanity. And this is a time in the history of the species where we really need to have to reinvent our healthcare systems and our societies to be more sustainable. We're back to the climate crisis again. I often say the greatest threat to the quality of life for people with dementia is the climate crisis and the environment. Why? Well, partly because people with dementia can't escape from nursing homes and run away from floods and they get dehydrated when it's hot and all those kinds of things, but partly because it's the greatest threat to all of us. So this idea of the metaphor of a lever, if we can, in this book, in some small way, shift people thinking away from magic bullets and simple fixes, and if it's a health problem, it's a doctor's issue, and say, no, they're not magic fixes, except they're wonderful when they involve intergenerational relationships and learning together and addressing public health issues, that if we fix some of the issues that will help people with dementia, we will fix issues that affect everybody going forward. Not only today's elders, but when the kids in our intergenerational school become elders decades from now.
Yes, indeed. You talk about it. I think you've looked at the relationship between poverty and brain health. What have you found out there?
Yeah, I mean, there are some really interesting studies, for instance, that have looked at brain bank data and correlated that with sort of neighborhood vulnerability indexes, and found, you know, it correlates pretty strongly, the neuropathology in people's brains in highly vulnerable regions or neighborhoods. But yeah, we have a whole chapter in the book that looks at this dynamic through the lens of the Fight for 15 movement, which is mostly fast food workers who are trying to get a $15 minimum wage implemented. And, you know, we know what healthy diets impact brain health. It's Mediterranean diets, low sodium diets. And if you're poor, working class in this country, it's almost impossible to eat that kind of a diet, right? It's almost impossible to exercise. We know exercise is good. It improves vascular health, which we know is vital for brain health. It increases, neurotropic growth factors in the brain, all of these things. And if you're working multiple jobs, you know, you don't have time to exercise. If you're poor, you have more stress, more anxiety, more depression. All of these too are risk factors for brain aging. You have more exposure to air pollution and other toxins and environments, lead peeling off of the paint of homes, lead in soil, in inner city soil that hasn't been remediated. So yeah, if you're poor in this country, your overall health is worse and your brain health is worse typically. And so, you know, I just want to go back to what Peter is saying and kind of reinforce, make a through line from what we talked about in the mid 20th century, when the state was making investments in the population that benefited tens of millions of people, and ask, what can we do collectively moving forward as we're trying to escape our current American dementia to bring about a healthier society? And as Peter's saying, you know, we need to fix our healthcare system. The fact that there's 80 million under or uninsured people in this country is unconscionable. We could implement tuition-free higher education and free vocational training for people. That would get tens of millions of more people, in my generation or even younger, into formal education opportunities that would be good for their brains. We could have a job guarantee and a living wage, that would help people escape from the precarity and stress of working class lives. And, there's a lot of little things that we can do, as Peter says, if we use our approach to dementia as a lever. And our book, being a other help book, as we say, tries to get people to think about those large scale things we can do together if we put our collective will and feel a part of something bigger than our individual consumer selves.
There is another word that we haven't used yet, which Danny taught to me, so therefore I will share it. And it is the other side of the poverty coin. And that is the word neoliberalism. The idea that market fundamentalism pretty much around the world has led to an oligarchy, a small group of wealthy people in every society you look at who have an inordinate share. And they're so wealthy that they think having ruined this planet, you know, they're going to fly to some other planet. So they're investing in rockets and so on. And I won't point any fingers at anybody specifically. But the fact is, it's not just poverty, it's income inequity. You can have same degrees of poverty in countries, but if you don't have the income and equity, the health outcomes aren't as bad. So the fact is, we've got to take on the billionaires and the people who have so much money that it's frankly obscene, and say it's time for a little redistribution before we have a little revolution.
Yeah, yeah. What do we learn from the pandemic in relation to the issues that you talk about in the book?
So I'm going to start with that because I just spent some time talking about that. I'm afraid we're in a bit of trouble. I mean, the appropriate response to the COVID is public health. Now, admittedly, vaccines are obviously an important part of that, but it's the collective will to say, that I'm going to get vaccinated not only to protect me, but to protect my loved ones and the people that I come in contact with. And I would say that this plays out in, for example, how many vaccines does the North get and the global South doesn't get, or and how many vaccines do people of color get and don't get. I hope that we're learning. What's coming out of the new variant in South Africa, coming from South Africa, the Omicron variant, is that the governments have been quick to respond to that, to identify that, to figure out what we need to do about it. So I would say so far, COVID has not been a great model for international cooperation and equitable distribution of things. But that lesson is an ongoing lesson, and it's going to be ongoing for quite some time. So maybe we will learn from COVID that public health, solidarity, collective response, international responses are essential, and that that will then translate into the far bigger problem of the climate crisis that is going to follow whatever happens to this particular pandemic.
Go ahead, Dan.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I having spent the morning at an assisted living home, I'm also compelled to say how COVID reflected to us how inhumane our care for the elderly has been in this country. And, you know, we had homes at the outset of COVID that didn't have proper PPE. They had people crowding in bedrooms, sharing bathrooms, especially homes that didn't have unionized workforces. People just stopped showing up for work. And we don't pay people living wage in these homes, so they just didn't go into work. So, it magnified a lot of the problems in the infrastructure that we have to care for people. From a public health perspective, you know, we've so defunded our public health programs and infrastructure in this neoliberal era, where we've cut social services and social spending and, you know, sort of turned it over to the market to take care of things. You know, we didn't have proper surveillance and contact tracing at the outset of COVID. The fact that so many people have comorbidities like obesity and vascular disease and those things that put them at greater risk for mortality from COVID it reflects a failure of our public health system, of our healthcare system. So I think COVID was a tracer through our body politic that really exposed a lot of structural problems that have gone that have been papered over the decades as we've unleashed things into the market and sort of taken responsibility away from the state to take care of people.
Yeah. You talk about assisted living facilities, and we've kind of been monitoring some of the local ones where we live in Sonoma County, California. And what we've seen is that as they're being taken over by some major large companies that I think are buying up lots of them for economies of scale, is they start out with lots of glowing promises and so on, and maybe look quite nice to begin with, but very quickly seems to go downhill. The staff that they're hiring are uneducated by and large, and the wages are so low that it's just a really sad situation. So, yeah.
I shared the fact that my father-in-law was in assisted living and died with dementia and COVID just a few weeks ago. Yeah, assisted living is much less regulated, and the for-profit motive can manifest itself in ways that it does in nursing homes, for that matter. More problems with for-profit nursing homes in COVID, for example. The bus that rides around saying, you know, the next level of care. Well, I guess they were applying higher level, but and I don't want to be critical excessively, and I certainly don't want to identify the place, because it's a huge challenge to find people who are qualified. Let's go back to the, you know, minimum wage. This is a perfect example of how we don't prioritize care, and therefore we don't, or education, and we don't pay care workers and teachers enough. This is a perfect example. Long-term care is the vulnerable heel of dementia in many ways, the vulnerable heel of our whole healthcare system. So glad Danny brought that back into the conversation.
Yeah. Well, I've been hearing from guests who are in many ways very positively oriented people and have maybe built their career around spirituality or meditation, et cetera. But there's a rising chorus that climate is the thing that's going to do us in if we don't do something about that. So there's a lot of support for that. So I think your book is definitely on point, and I hope that it sells well. I hope that my listeners will go out and buy your book. Anything more before we wrap it up? I think we're kind of at the wrap-up place here.
Well, let me just say thank you for promoting our book. You know, Peter and I are not as good at promoting our book. And in fact, you know, I would just want to say if people don't buy the book, that's fine. What I'd rather have you do actually is volunteer in your community. Find a way to connect with people. Find some purpose in being for other people. That will be good for your brain health. It'll be good for your community. And, you know, that I think we need more of that at a time when people are feeling so alienated and atomized and fragmented along, you know, political lines and affiliations. And, you know, let's try to rebuild something out of the rubble of this mess that we've all just lived through.
And, Danny usually does. If you don't buy the book, you can go to AmericanDementia.com and see a lot of good stuff, too, for free. There you go, Danny. You forgot that.
That was impressive, Peter.
Well, that's a great wrap-up, you guys. Dr. Peter Whitehouse and Dr. Daniel George, I want to thank you for being my guests today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Our pleasure.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
American Dementia, Brain Health in an Unhealthy Society, by my guests Peter Whitehouse, MD, and Daniel George, PhD, comes at the questions surrounding Alzheimer's disease from an unexpected direction. Rather than touting the latest pharmaceutical remedy or brain training app, they point the finger at the ways in which our society is dysfunctional. In fact, they decry the illusory quest for a magical silver bullet drug fix. Anxieties about the pandemic and climate warning have somewhat superseded our worries about coming down with Alzheimer's. We've tended to hit the panic button when our memories for certain words or events begin to fade, and then with increasing frequency. Consequently, I was surprised to learn that Alzheimer's and other forms of brain-related dementia are decreasing in the U.S., Canada, and Northern European countries. Peter and Dan attribute this decline to advances in public health, such as cholesterol monitoring, blood pressure monitoring, reduced rates of smoking, heart-healthy dietary improvements, and reductions of known environmental toxins. These changes have resulted from science-informed governmental policies. Of course, these advances have not benefited all. Research has shown that poverty, income inequality, low social status, and other such factors are correlated with ill health in general, as well as higher rates of dementia. The setting of social policies is necessarily political. Peter and Dan are quite explicit about the damaging effects of rampant capitalism and individualism. Their recommended fix is pro-social, political, and spiritual. This comes across even in the book's dedication, which reads, and I quote, "To our families, to those affected by and at risk for dementia, and to the prospect of a more humane, hopeful, and sustainable future for all the species on our planet." Their view of the way ahead is both communal and intergenerational. They write, "In short, the political, economic, reordering of our society over the past several decades around hyper-capitalist principles has reduced our shared commitment to one another and made us less healthy in every sense, close quote. Their charge to us echoes that of many of my other recent guests, namely that we must support one another in small communities, not just for better health, but for our very survival. They write, and I quote, "In this moment of cultural tumult, let us venture forward together in solidarity, exploring our American dementia as a means of fostering collective action in service of better brain health, more compassionate treatment of those with memory loss, and, most importantly, the realization of a more just and humane world." Close quote. I hope these quotes from their book will inspire you to action, whether that means buying their book or going to their website at www.americandementia.com, where you'll find plenty of free supplementary materials. I come away from this interview with deep respect and admiration for these two brave and passionate warriors. The book, once again, is American Dementia, Brain Health in an Unhealthy Society by Peter Whitehouse, MD, and Daniel George, PhD.
Dr. Dave, I'm continuously inspired and educated by your podcast. You interview such a wide variety of sophisticated and intelligent guests in such a graceful, well-orchestrated, and easy-to-listen-to way. I learn so much from listening while I make art and organize my life. I want to make sure this podcast keeps up and running and will be supporting more as I am able to in the future. I'm currently just finishing up my master's degree at Southwestern College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, studying art therapy and counseling. Just want to say thanks for the many gifts your work offers others and much appreciation. And I hope to, donate more in the future, and I encourage others to do the same. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Santa Fe master's student, for your commitment and encouragement for others to keep the show on the air. Once again, as I review the honor roll in putting together today's podcast, I'm so appreciative of all you monthly donors. In fact, I'd like to read out the names of you monthly contributors whose donations have landed in the last several days. And you are Clive Van Hilton, James Alexander, Ann Chandler, Sorka McGrath, Terry Keller, Beverly Shayer, and Mark Morris. You ongoing donors are more important than ever. I've had to close down my market research consulting business. Income from my continuing education courses has declined. Also, the company that was bringing me occasional ad sponsors has dropped me because my numbers of listeners has declined. Just this week, I was approached by a new advertising sales company in the health and wellness area. They approached me with great enthusiasm about their ability to bring me more sponsors. However, I turned them down because it would have meant shortening my interviews and inserting two ad spots into each episode. Years ago, I started out with shorter episodes, but I heard from listeners that they wanted more depth in the interviews, and so I went to the longer format. So I'm assuming that you still like my in-depth interviews, and I'm not keen on interrupting your listening experience with ads. The independent podcasters like me are a threatened species. You may be aware that more and more podcasts are produced by whole teams of people. Aside from becoming a monthly donor, you can help by evangelizing Shrink Wrap Radio to your friends, family, and colleagues. Well, enough of that. So once again, it's time to shrink wrap it up. Thanks to Drs. Peter Whitehouse and Daniel George for their book, American Dementia, Brain Health in an Unhealthy Society, and for their impassioned wake-up call. My next interview will be with return guest, neuroscientist Dr. Arielle Garten, inventor of the Muse Brain Scanning headset, and she'll be sharing the latest developments in the brain feedback arena. So until then, this is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourselves and others.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.